This is Fred Hunhart, and I'm with Vic Strecker, and it is February 4th, 2003. And as you can see, we've got a tape recorder here. Do we have your permission to tape this?
Yes, you have.
Good. If you could start out just giving some of your background, where you were born and raised.
All right. Like Ralph, I was born and raised in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Actually spent about 8 of my years on Pewaukee Lake, and then moved to Milwaukee and attended the public schools through high school, and then attended the University of Wisconsin Extension in Milwaukee as a chemistry student for almost 2 years. My folks were both factory workers, both immigrants from Slovenia and Hungary. And my dad was a welder. My mother was an inspector of electrical parts at Globe Union. My dad worked on airplane engines during World War II and all of that. And so we had some connection with the war effort. We lived on the north side, whereas Ralph lived on the west side of the city. He went to Washington High School, and I went to Rufus King High School, but my wife went to Washington some years after Ralph did. We're about 15 years different in age.
What's your birth date, Vic?
Pardon me?
What's your birth date?
July 29, 31, and just about 15 years.
Right.
And so a half a generation separated us. And I went to Madison after being a chemistry student to be a music student. I'd been studying music, scratching a few bucks together here and there in Milwaukee with an old composer and a choral conductor, and a sax player once played with Kenton and things like that. So I majored in music in at Wisconsin in Madison, starving. Spring semester of 51, and that's how I got to find my way to Ralph. Should I just go on with that?
Yeah.
What happened? I took all my classes in Bascom Hall up on the hill, or in Music Hall at the bottom of that hill, and I lived in a $2 a week room across from the railroad tracks. And on my way to school, I would walk past a row of buildings on State Street, one of which was the Wisconsin State Crime Lab. It's just a storefront lab with paint up to about chin level. So I would walk past and I'd look in at these guys. And back then I was just a total musician. And I went in one day and I said, "What are you cats doing here?" like some dance musician. And they said, "Well, we analyze evidence." And I met the head of the lab, who was named Wilson. And he showed me around. He was very cordial. And he knew I was a student. And I said, "How do you get to be one of these?" And he said, "Well, old Doc Matthews, the head of the chemistry department here, has trained a few people, but the person he trained the most highly is over at Michigan State. But why don't you go and see Doc? He might take you on since you've had 2 years with Kim." So I did, and he was in his office, and he showed me through his lab all of the instruments that he himself had developed that later Ralph acquired and, in fact, wanted to put on display here on the campus,
right.
And that didn't work out. But he showed me his comparison microscope, and he showed me his little camera that goes over a developed fingerprint with an internal light source, and demonstrated all these. And I asked him if he would take me on through the rest of my chemistry degree and if I could become his apprentice. He said, "I would, but I'm going on a sabbatical for 2 years, and it's a retirement sabbatical. And I'm going to spend as much of it in Europe as I can. But here, gave me Ralph Turner's name, address, and phone number. And so I wrote a letter, not expecting, you know, I didn't know anything at that time. So I wrote a letter saying that I'd be interested in working with Ralph. And he immediately, I mean, I don't think a week passed, he immediately sent me an application for Michigan State and a nice letter, and invited me to come over. He said, get your transcripts and so forth, and get the, well, I did right away. But this was 1951, and it was late spring, and Michigan State had an enormous influx of veterans at that time. They were jammed in everywhere, the married housing complexes and the Quonset huts, all the rest of it. And so I stayed in touch with Ralph and asked if I was going to be accepted because I hadn't gotten an acceptance. And so he said, come on over. So I packed my one suitcase, got on a bus, and came to East Lansing. And I got off the bus and walked across to the campus with my suitcase and went into the administration building. And they said, yes, you have been accepted. They directed me to the College of Business and Public Service.
Right.
And Dean Weingarten was in charge at that time. And they had an acceptance for me, and they said, you have to stay in a dormitory, go to Phillips Hall, and all the rest of that. And so I did that, and then I walked over to the Quonset huts where I was directed and met Ralph for the first time. During registration week of the fall term, we had quarters then.
Right.
So I met him. I took his criminalistics investigation courses and others, fingerprint course for 1 credit, everything he offered.
What was he like as a teacher?
He was, of course, because of his speech impediment, he was a very deliberate, careful teacher, and his style of delivery was not especially liked by a lot of students. They would get impatient. He would hang up on a word, and he would then get out a cigar. Today, that would be unthinkable, but he'd get out a cigar, and he'd handle it a little bit, and sometimes he'd light it. And if he really got hung up. Well, the impediment over the years really changed a great deal. Back then it was still a little bit severe. When he told me at one time when he took over the Kansas City Crime Lab in 1938, I think it was, or started it,
right,
really.
Started,
he initiated
yeah.
it. I've been told, he told me, he could barely speak at all. It was very hard for him to communicate. And sometimes on the witness stand, that was difficult. But by this time, he used to tell me, well, at one time I couldn't talk, and now I make my living talking. And he was quite proud of the fact that he had beaten it. And but I was one of those who thought, well, he does take a long time to say things, but he is the most thorough preparer. I'll tell you how thorough. I took police records management from him. And a lot of students would say, ah, that stuff. 10 years later, in 1962, I was assistant director of planning in the St. Louis Police Department. And we had to redo our entire record system. We were going to move into new quarters and computerize it. Everything that Ralph taught in 1952 spring worked 10 years later in St. Louis. Every single thing. Master name index files, numbers connected with alphabetic file, everything, all the principles he taught were absolutely germane to what I did. And it ended up with a 54-page project in the procedures manual, how to run the records bureau. And it was about half Ralph Turner. Just astonishing how well he had taught me, because I just plain remembered what he had taught me. So he was, you know, among teachers, Bob Scott, of course, was the philosopher lawyer,
mm-hmm.
and he was entertaining, he was popular, he was glib.
Lots of puns.
Yeah, he was, oh, yes, pun master.
Exactly.
He told some, he got off some puns that were unbelievably quick and could not have been forethought. It, astonishing mind. But that's not Ralph.
No.
But years later, my reflection was that I may have used Bob's ethical teachings a great deal, and perhaps a humanistic outlook, but I used Ralph's knowledge much more. So they influenced students in totally different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And Ralph, what he taught was so principled and grounded in reality that it all stayed real. The investigation course, I can deal with criminal investigation today from the notebook that I wrote in his course. It's as good as most of what we see in the textbooks. So, and of course he had us do a lot of practical work. And he taught us about firearms. He would bring all kinds of guns to the class, which today he'd have a furor over something
yes.
like that. But we'd go to a range and fire some, and he'd show how the FBI teaches quick loading and things like that. And he taught us about the practical pistol course versus target shooting. His breadth of knowledge was astonishing. Everywhere he went, he learned something.
Mm-hmm.
And he went everywhere he could. He had a list at one time of 19 or 20 things he wanted to do in his lifetime. And I once saw the list, but it's been so many years. But one of the things was Machu Picchu. And that was way back before it became a tourist attraction.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to see China
mm-hmm.
very much. And he wanted to see Polynesia. He wanted to see South America, Australia, Africa, and the Middle East. But that was just one item. He wanted to see the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, for instance.
But have a little problem with that one.
I know. He wrote these things at some point in his life out of intense curiosity to see what is that really like. And so he had the list, and he may have scratched some of them off, but my feeling is that he probably got most of them. He is pretty persistent about getting to China and getting back to China. He wanted the mainland so badly, but he took Taiwan
mm-hmm.
As a substitute two or three times, and then
right.
finally got to the mainland.
Right.
But I realize I've strayed way off okay. Ralph as a teacher, but, you know, we were in those Quonset huts, and And they were connected to the campus police station.
Right.
Because Art was the chief of the campus police as well as having having the school.
Right.
And so our offices were right there, and we would see each other all the time. And one thing Ralph didn't do, he didn't forget about students once they graduated.
That's my next question.
He always stayed in touch with people and remembered who they were and what they were doing and was always interested in how they were doing. And so on the campus police, when I made sergeant, he...
Okay, let me clarify.
You
went from graduating from MSU and then joined the campus police?
I did.
That's my assumption. Okay.
I did. It was, you know... Los Angeles PD at that time was advertising that they wanted educated people from all over the country, and my field training partner, Charlie Egler, and I both wrote in letters to personnel and never got a response from Los Angeles. Charlie went with the Department of Corrections. I went with the campus police because I wanted some immediate experience, and actually... I got to do things I wouldn't have got to do in a big city department for several years. I got a detective assignment in which I worked on two homicides and several sexual assaults and some serious drug things going
on. Here
on
campus?
Yeah, all on campus or involving the campus in some way. For instance, there was a gang of people who were stripping cars and stealing cars, and they were working out of Langsburg. And so I was on detective duty at that time, so I got to work on a stolen car ring and a car stripping ring, and this was four or five people out there in a ramshackle house. One night, I'm tailing them there at my lieutenant's direction, and I get stuck in a ditch, and they come out of the house, and I thought, oh boy, well, our radio in the plane car was in the glove compartment, so they come by and say, hey, buddy, can we help? They helped me get my car out there, and about 3 months later, we arrested them after we had compiled everything. They looked at me and said, hey, you're the guy. And but that's a different story, too. But yes, I back then, field service training was 3 semesters long. After you finished all of your academic work, you had to go. Have you heard any of this before?
No, okay. Go ahead.
Ralph said more than once that the major difference between Michigan State's program and any other program in the country was that every student who completed the degree had 9 months of intensive exposure to every agency in criminal justice. Now that sounds exaggerated, but we would spend between 1 and 4 weeks, 4 weeks with a state police post, living at the post, 2 weeks with a sheriff's department, a total probably of 2 or 3 months in Detroit with various segments of the Detroit PD, Recorder's Court. We had to be assigned to a court, to the Liquor Control Commission, to a retail credit investigative agency, to an industrial security plant. I was with Oldsmobile for 2 weeks on that, with a fire marshal, a major prison for a month, a youth facility. Altogether, if you look at the whole thing, you looked at everything at the front end of the justice process, juvenile and adult, police, city, county, state, and federal. Mm-hmm. We all went to the Secret Service or the FBI or one of those. I went to two. I went to three, narcotics, alcohol, tax, and Secret Service. So we got a view of the local, state, and federal agencies in enforcement. Then we saw the courts. We spent a week with a prosecuting attorney's office to see what they do. And then we went to the incarceration facilities, juvenile and adult probation, parole office, and at least two prisons and several jails. Well, you can imagine how that was for us. You suddenly have a fairly realistic idea of how the whole system works. And Ralph always said, that's the difference between Michigan State and these schools where they crank you through 4 years of classroom work and out into the field, and you've got to decide without any real knowledge whether you want to be a cop or go into the law or corrections work or juvenile work. And we had a fair idea after going through all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think our people went into every one of those kinds of agencies. Everything I just named, I think, people went into, including, you know, Gordon Kettler, who was very big. He started in plant security. I'm going to get the company wrong, with a major automotive company, and he's now a major contributor to the program. He's a vice president for security and something else. Anyway, he started that way. Two heads of the U.S. Secret Service came mm-hmm. through the program, you know, things like that. The head of Narcotics Bureau. I look at that, and I think this thing they put together between Art and Ralph, because Ralph was his true sidekick.
Mm-hmm.
He was Sancho Panza all the way. But I asked Ralph a couple of times, haven't you ever wanted to run it? He said, no. He said, actually not. Well, that became my ambition, to run a program. But Ralph said, no, I'm doing the things that I think are important. And Art does what he thinks is important, and I help him all I can. And he was satisfied with that role all through his career. He knew what he wanted to be, and he was that. But he turned out to be one other thing, and again, I'm straying here. He became, well, I think we'll have to get back to it later, he became the host for the school.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was ever explicit. I don't think Art ever said, you know, this would be good. It came out of Ralph's natural proclivity to get to know people and to enjoy their company and to want to eat and drink with them. But I guess you started this with where I came from, so we pretty much have that.
When you came here to the MSU, what year was that that you...
51 September.
Now, Ralph had been involved, I know from my work on him, with alcohol research. Was he still doing that, or had he finished that when you came here?
Not at all, having finished it. He was doing it, and when I was on... In 1953, as a member of the campus police, I was actually involved in driving home his subjects. He used a lot of police officers from surrounding agencies. I remember a lot of East Lansing officers, some Lansing, some state police. He never used students. He used police officers who could give informed consent. And in going through the experiments and doing the tests and everything, they would get pretty plastered. And Ralph was careful to inform their spouses that this was going on. And I would take these guys and had to help them get up to their door in many cases. And the fact that I was in uniform, he thought would help. And it did. We'd explain he's been in this experiment, and we just want to be sure, because we'd get him there and we'd get him back home. So I watched this with great interest, and I would watch them doing the tests, the mirror tracings, and the brake pedal test, response time and all of that, reaction time. And I thought it was great work. And I realized what was going on. They were, at that time, he and his friend, close friend, Bob Borkenstein, at Indiana, were both doing this kind of work. And they were trying to correlate volumetric results from breath, from urine, and from blood to see
how
they compare with degree of impairment. Because obviously there are some differences in where the alcohol is. And Borkenstein invented the breathalyzer and became quite rich from that. Ralph did a lot of the work that went into that sort of thing and never went for any kind of a commercial side of it at all, which is an interesting thing about him. Borky did. Borky just died 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, long retired from Indiana. But, the alcohol work was great work. Many years later, I'm now at Sam Houston State University as dean of the College of Criminal Justice there. And we have 50 Saudi Arabian students, okay? We're training them for the highway patrol, and it's a 2.5-year project. This was a big program. I hired another graduate of MSU who had been head of investigations for AID for 12 years, and then retired from that, Paul Shields.
Oh, yeah.
You know about Paul.
I've met him, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
He
came here for
for the opening.
Right, exactly.
Sure. Well, Paul, I hired him to run the program because it was a big thing. And we had a big segment on alcohol because it is such a problem in Saudi Arabia, which is supposed to be a dry country. But when they drink...
They drink.
Oh. And that went for the students, too. Well, Ralph ran them through the entire alcohol training thing. He spent a week with us, I think, maybe a little more. And so he took all of the results from those 1950s studies and made use of them in the 1980s with an international audience. And he used some of the staff there. We had one guy who must have weighed 300 pounds, former highway patrolman from California, Art Smith. And Ralph tried to get him impaired. And Art Smith drank close to a quart of whiskey and was still doing everything well. And Ralph wrote this up as a note. I don't know if it's in his archives, but he wrote it up because he said, I have never, in all of my years of doing this, found anyone who could drink that much and not be impaired. But this guy was huge. And so Ralph still was adjusting his sights 30 years after he did that work, and he wrote it up. I don't know if he published it anywhere, but he certainly made note of it and said, here's a case now where you could take this guy to court with this enormous blood alcohol level, and he's doing everything correctly. That was a sidelight on the alcohol studies, but the alcohol studies also connected with Marshall Houts.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure you know about Marsh.
Mm. Marsh, you go ahead.
Okay.
And I think we're just about at the end of this particular tape, so we'll...
Okay, just wave me off when it hits. So Marsh Houts came there in about 1956 or 7. And he had been an FBI agent who worked on the Nazis in South America. He helped crack that ring. He'd been a judge. he was obviously a lawyer, and he was on Earl Stanley Gardner's Court of Last Resort as their head counsel. He led the law team. And in fact, I brought this book because there's a long foreword about Marsh Houts in The Worried Waitress by Earl Stanley Gardner. And this is not just a note, it's a three-page dedication to Marsh Houts. Well, he was close to Gardner for many years in California before he came to Michigan State. And then when he started his medical legal journal, Trauma Magazine, he moved back and lived just south of Los Angeles. Well, anyway, he had a big hillside home and a bunch of kids, 8 or 9 kids, and a room for every one of them in this place, Laguna Beach.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And Trauma Magazine was a huge success. It was for lawyers and physicians in all medical legal cases. It dealt with every issue of dealing with trauma, and but especially the legal side that both doctors and lawyers